Side 4. Fantastic Voyage by Isaac Asimov. Continuing on page 149. But now a low rasp made itself felt in Grant's ear. It grew slowly louder, and Grant realized an exhalation was beginning. He braced himself and held on to the snorkel. Owen said jubilantly, "This is working beautifully. Nothing like this has ever been done before." The motion of air was making itself felt about Grant as the lungs continued their slow but accelerating collapse and the rasp of exhalation grew louder. Grant felt his legs lifting from the alveolar floor. On an ordinary scale, he knew, the air current in the alveolus was indetectably gentle, but on the miniaturized scale, it was gathering into a tornado. Grant gripped the snorkel in desperation, flinging both arms about it and both legs. It strained upward, and so did he. The very boulders, dust boulders, came loose and rolled slightly. The wind slowly died then as the exhalation came to its slow halt, and Grant released the snorkel with relief. He said, "How's it doing, Owens?"
"Almost done. Hang on for a few seconds, will you, Grant?"
"Okay." He counted to himself. 20, 30, 40. The inhalation was starting, and air molecules were impinging upon him. The alveolar wall was stretching again, and he stumbled to his knees.
"Full!" cried Owens. "Get back in!"
"Pull down on the snorkel," yelled Grant. "Quickly, before another exhalation comes." He pushed downward, and they pulled. Difficulty arose only when the lip of the snorkel approached the interface. It held tight there for a moment, as though in a vice, and then pulled through with a small thunderclap of joining surface film. Grant had watched too long. With the snorkel safely in, he made a motion as though to plunge into the crevice and through the interface at its bottom, but the beginning of the exhalation surrounded him with wind and caused him to stumble. For a moment, he was wedged between two dust boulders, and he found that in wrenching free, he had slightly barked one shin. Hurting one shin against a particle of dust was surely something to tell one's grandchildren. Where was he? He shook his lifeline, freeing it from some snag on one of the boulders, and pulled it taut. It would be easiest to follow it back to the crevice. The lifeline snaked over the top of the boulder, and Grant, bracing his feet against it, climbed rapidly upward. The strengthening exhalation helped him do so, and there was scarcely any sensation of effort in the upward striving. Then, still less. The crevice, he knew, was just the other side of the boulder, and he might have gone about it but for the fact that the exhalation made the route over it the simpler, and because, why not admit it, it was more exciting this way. The boulder rolled beneath his feet at the peak of the exhalation wind, and Grant lifted free. For a moment, he found himself high in the air, the crevice just beyond, exactly where he had expected it to be. It was only necessary to wait a second or two for exhalation to cease, and he would lunge quickly for the crevice, the bloodstream, and the ship. And even as he thought so, he felt himself sucked wildly upward, the lifeline following and whipping entirely free of the crevice, which, in half a moment, was lost to sight. The snorkel had been pulled out of the alveolar crevice, and Duval was getting it back to the ship. Cora said anxiously, "Where's Grant?"
"He's up there," said Michaels, peering.
"Why doesn't he come down?"
"He will, he will. It takes some negotiating, I imagine."
He peered upward again.
"Benish is exhaling. Once that's done, he'll have no trouble."
"Shouldn't we grab hold of his lifeline and pull him in?" Michaels threw out an arm and forestalled her.
"If you do that and yank, just as an inhalation starts, forcing him downward, you may hurt him. He'll tell us what to do if he needs help."
Restlessly, Cora watched and then broke away toward the lifeline.
"Now," she said, "I want to..."
And at that moment, the lifeline twitched and snaked upward, its end flashing past and out through the opening. Cora screamed and kicked herself desperately toward the opening. Michaels pursued.
"You can't do anything," he panted. "Don't be foolish."
"But we can't leave him in there. What will happen to him?"
"We'll hear from him by his radio.
It may be broken."
"Why should it be?"
Duval joined them. He said chokingly,
"It came loose as I watched. I couldn't believe it."
All three gazed upward helplessly. Michaels called tentatively,
"Grant! Grant! Do you receive me?"
Grant went tumbling and twisting upward, the useless lifeline still attached to his belt and whipping behind him. His thoughts were as jumbled as his line of flight.
"I won't get back," was the dominant thought. "I won't get back. Even if I stay in radio contact, I can't come in on the beam.
Or could he?
Michaels, he called. Duval. There was nothing at first, then a faint crackling noise in his ears, and a distorted squawk that might have been Grant. He tried again.
Michaels, do you hear me? Do you hear me?
Again the squawking. He could not make out anything. Somewhere within a tense mind there came a calm thought, as though his intellect had found time to make a serene note. Although miniaturized light waves were more penetrating than the ordinary kind, miniaturized radio waves seemed less penetrating. Very little was known about the miniaturized state, apparently. It was the misfortune of the Proteus and her crew to be pioneers into a realm that was literally unknown. Surely a fantastic voyage, if ever there was one. And within that voyage, Grant was now on a fantastic sub-voyage of his own, blown through what seemed miles of space within a microscopic air chamber in the lung of a dying man. His motion was slowing. He had reached the top of the alveolus and had moved into the tubular stalk from which it was suspended. The far-off light of the Proteus was dim indeed. Could he follow the light, then? Could he try to move in whatever direction it seemed stronger? He touched the wall of the tubular stalk and stuck there, like a fly on flypaper. And with no more sense than the fly, at first he wriggled. Both legs and an arm were stuck to the wall in no time. He paused and forced himself to think. Exhalation was complete, but inhalation would be beginning. The air current would be forcing him downward. Wait for it. He felt the wind begin and heard the rushing noise. Slowly, he pulled his clinging arm loose and bent his body out into the wind. It pushed him downward, and his legs came loose, too. He was falling now, plunging downward from a height which, on his miniaturized scale, was mountainous. From the unminiaturized point of view, he knew he must be drifting downward in feathery fashion, but as it was, what he experienced was a plummet. It was a smooth drop, non-accelerated, for the large molecules of air, almost large enough to see, Michaels had said, had to be pushed to one side as he fell, and that took the energy that would otherwise have gone into acceleration. A bacterium, no larger than he, could fall this distance safely, but he, the miniaturized human, was made up of 50 trillion miniaturized cells, and that complexity made him fragile enough, perhaps, to smash apart into miniaturized dust. Automatically, as he thought that, he threw up his hands in self-defense when the alveolar wall came whirling close. He felt the glancing contact. The wall gave soggily, and he bounced off after clinging for a moment. His speed of fall had actually slowed. Down again. Somewhere below, a speck of light, a bare pinpoint, had winked on as he watched. He kept his eye fixed on that with a wild hope. Still down. He kicked his feet wildly to avoid an outcropping of dust boulders. He narrowly missed them and struck a spongy area again. Again falling. He thrashed wildly in an attempt to move toward the pinpoint of light as he fell, and it seemed to him he may have succeeded somewhat. He wasn't sure. He came rolling down the lower slope of the alveolar surface at length. He flung his lifeline around an outcropping and just barely held on. The pinpoint of light had become a small glare, some 50 feet away, he judged. That must be the crevice, and close though it was, he couldn't possibly have found it without the guidance of the light. He waited for the inhalation to cease. In the short interval of time before exhalation, he had to make it there. Before inhalation had come to a complete halt, he was slipping and scrambling across the space between. The alveolar membrane stretched in the final moment of inhalation, and then, hovering at that point for a couple of seconds, began to lose its tension as the first instance of gathering exhalation began. Grant threw himself down the crevice, which was ablaze with light. He kicked at the interface, which rebounded in rubbery fashion. A knife slid through. A hand appeared and seized his ankle in firm grip. He felt the pull downward just as the upward draft was beginning to make itself felt about his ears. Down he went, with other hands adding to the grip on his legs, and he was back in the capillary. Grant breathed in long, shuddering gasps. Finally, he said, "Thanks. I followed the light. Couldn't have made it otherwise." Michael said, "Couldn't reach you by radio." Cora was smiling at him. "It was Dr. Duval's idea. He had the Proteus move up to the opening and shine its headlight directly into it. And he made the opening bigger, too." Michael said,
Let's get back in the ship. We've lost just about all the time we can afford to lose.
Chapter 13. Pleura. Reed cried out,
"A message is coming through, Al."
"From the Proteus?"
Carter ran to the window.
"Well, not from your wife."
Carter waved his hand impatiently.
"Later, later. Save all the jokes and we'll go over them one by one in a big heap, okay?"
The word came through.
"Sir, Proteus reports dangerous air loss. Refueling stop carried through successfully."
"Refueling?"
cried Carter. Reed said, frowning,
"I suppose they mean the lungs.
They're at the lungs, after all, and that means cubic miles of air on their scale, but..."
"But what?"
"They can't use that air. It's unminiaturized." Carter looked at the colonel in exasperation. He barked into the transmitter,
"Repeat the last sentence of the message."
"Refueling stop carried through successfully."
"Is that last word successfully?"
"Yes, sir."
"Get in touch with them and confirm,"
he said to Reed.
"If they say successfully, I suppose they handled it."
"The Proteus has a miniaturizer on board."
"Then that's how they did it."
"We'll get an explanation afterward." The voice came up from communications.
"Message confirmed, sir."
"Are they moving?"
asked Carter, making another connection. A short pause, and then,
"Yes, sir, they're moving through the pleura lining."
Reed nodded his head. He looked up at the time recorder, which read 37, and said,
"The pleura lining is a double membrane surrounding the lungs. They must be moving in the space between. A clear road, an expressway, really, right to the neck."
"And they'll be where they started half an hour ago," grated Carter. "Then what?"
"They can back into a capillary and find their way to the carotid artery again, which is time-consuming. Or they may bypass the arterial system by taking to the lymphatics, which involves other problems. Michaels is the pilot. I suppose he'll know what to do."
"Can you advise him? For God's sake, don't rest on protocol."
Reed shook his head.
"I'm not sure which course is wisest, and he's on the scene. He'll be a better judge as to how well the ship can withstand another arterial battering. We've got to leave it to them, General."
"I wish I knew what to do," said Carter. "By the Lord, I'd take the responsibility if I knew enough to do so with a reasonable chance of success."
"But that's exactly how I feel," said Reed, "and why I'm declining the responsibility."
Michaels was looking over the charts.
"All right, Owens. This wasn't the place I was heading for, but it will do. We're here, and we've made an opening. Head for the crevice."
"Into the lungs?" said Owens, in outrage.
"No, no."
Michaels bounded from his seat in impatience and climbed the stairs so that his head poked into the bubble.
"We'll get into the pleura lining. Get the ship going, and I'll guide you."
Cora knelt at Grant's chair.
"How did you manage?"
Grant said,
"Barely."
Then impatiently he went on, "I kept thinking, why the devil am I here?"
Cora said, "Surely you know..."
Grant said, "No, I don't.
The rest of you are driven by specific motivation, not by vague words. Owens is testing his ship. Michaels is piloting a course across a human body. Duval is admiring God's handiwork. And you..."
"Yes?"
Grant said softly,
"You are admiring Duval."
Cora flushed.
"He's worth admiration. He really is. You know, after he suggested we shine the ship's headlights into the crevice so as to give you something to shoot for, he did nothing further. He wouldn't say a word to you on your return. It's his way. He'll save someone's life, then be casually rude to him, and what will be remembered will be his rudeness and not his life-saving. But his manner doesn't alter what he is."
"No, that's true, though it may mask it."
"Well, in any case, I've got to get to work on the laser."
She cast a quick glance at Michaels, who was returning to his seat.
"The laser? Good Lord, I'd forgotten."
"Well, then, do your best to see it's not crucially damaged, will you?" The animation that had brightened her through the previous conversation died away.
"Oh, if I only could."
She moved to the rear. Michael's eyes followed her.
"What about the laser?"
he said. Grant shook his head.
"She's going to check now."
Michaels seemed to hesitate before his next remark. He shook his head slightly. Grant watched him, but said nothing. Michaels settled himself into a seat and said at last,
"What do you think of our present situation?"
Grant, until now absorbed in Cora, looked up at the windows,
They seemed to be moving between two walls that almost touched the Proteus on either side, gleaming yellow and constructed of parallel fibers, like huge tree trunks bound side by side. The fluid about them was clear, free of cells and objects, almost free of debris. It seemed to be in dead calm, and the Proteus churned through it at an even, rapid clip with only the muffled Brownian motion to interject any unevenness into its progress.
The Brownian motion, said Grant, is rougher now.
The fluid here is less viscous than the blood plasma, so the motion is less damped out. We won't be here long, however.
We're not in the bloodstream, I take it, then?
Does it look like it? This is the space between the folds of the pleural membrane that lines the lungs. The membrane on that side is fixed to the ribs. In fact, we ought to be able to see a huge, gentle bulge when we pass one of them. The other membrane is fixed to the lungs. If you want the names, they are the parietal pleura and the pulmonary pleura, respectively.
I don't really want the names.
I didn't really think you did. What we're in now is a film of lubricating moisture between the pleurae. When the lungs expand during inhalation or contract during exhalation, they move against the ribs, and this fluid cushions and smooths the motion. They're so thin a film that the folds of the pleurae are commonly considered in contact in the healthy body, but being germ size, we can sneak between the folds through the film of fluid.
When the lung wall moves along the ribcage, doesn't that affect us?
We are alternately hurried along slightly and held back slightly, not enough to matter.
Hey, said Grant, have these membranes anything to do with pleurisy?
They surely do. When the pleurae are infected and inflamed, every breath becomes an agony, and coughing...
What happens if Benish coughs?
Michael shrugged.
In our position now, I suppose it would be fatal. We'd come apart. There's no reason for coughing, however. He's under hypothermia and in deep sedation, and his pleurae, take my word for it, are in good condition.
But if we irritate them,
we're too small to do that.
Are you sure?
We can speak only in terms of probabilities. The probability of a cough now is too small to worry about.
His face was quite calm.
I see, said Grant, and looked back to see what Cora was doing. She and Duval were in the workroom, both heads bent closely over the bench. Grant rose and went to the doorway. Michaels joined him. On a section of opal glass, illuminated from below into bright milkiness, the laser lay disassembled, each part etched sharp and clear against the light.
What are the total damages now? Demanded Duval, crisply.
Just those items, Doctor, and this broken trigger wire. That's all.
Thoughtfully, Duval seemed to be counting the parts, touching each with a delicate finger and moving it.
The key to the situation, then, is this smashed transistor. What it amounts to is that there's no way now to fire the lamp, and that's the end of the laser.
Grant interrupted. Are there no spare parts?
Cora looked up. Her glance drifted guiltily away from Grant's firm eyes. She said, Not anything built into the chassis. We would have brought a second laser, but who could have... If it hadn't come loose,
Michael said somberly,
Are you serious, Dr. Duval? Is the laser unusable?
A note of impatience crept into Duval's voice.
I'm always serious. Now don't bother me.
He seemed lost in thought.
Michael shrugged.
That's it, then. We've gone through the heart, and we've filled our air chambers of the lungs, and all for nothing. We can't go on.
Why not? Demanded Grant.
Of course, we can go on as a matter of physical ability. It's just that there's no point in it, Grant. Without a laser, there's nothing we can do.
Grant said, Dr. Duval, is there any way of performing the operation without the laser?
I'm thinking,
snapped Duval.
Then share your thoughts,
snapped back Grant.
Duval looked up.
No, there's no way of performing the operation without the laser.
But operations were performed for centuries without a laser. You cut through the lung wall with your knife. That was an operation. Can't you cut away the clot with your knife?
Of course I can, but not without damaging the nerve and placing an entire lobe of the brain in danger. The laser is incredibly more delicate than a knife. In this particular case, a knife would be butchery compared with a laser.
But you can save Benish's life with a knife, can't you?
I think so. Just maybe. I can't necessarily save his mind, however.
In fact, I should think it almost certain that an operation with a knife would bring Benish through with serious mental deficiencies. Is that what you want?
Grant rubbed his chin. I'll tell you, we're heading for that clot. When we get there, if all we've got is a knife, you'll use a knife, Duval. If we lose our knives, you'll use your teeth, Duval. If you don't, I will. We may fail, but we won't quit. Meanwhile, let's look at the damn thing. He pushed between Duval and Cora and picked up the transistor, which lay neatly on the tip of his first finger. Is this the broken one?
Yes, said Cora.
If this were fixed or replaced, could you make the laser operate?
Yes, but there's no way of fixing it.
Suppose you had another transistor about this size and power output and a thin enough wire. Could you piece it together?
I don't think I could. It requires such absolute precision.
Perhaps you couldn't, but what about you, Dr. Duval? Your surgeon's fingers might be able to do it despite the Brownian motion. I could try, with Miss Peterson's help, but we don't have the parts. Grant said, yes, we do. I can supply them.
He seized a heavy metal screwdriver and moved purposefully back into the front compartment. He went to his wireless and, without hesitation, began to unscrew the panel. Michaels moved behind him, seizing his elbow.
What are you doing, Grant? Grant shook himself free. I'm getting at its guts.
You mean you're going to dismantle the wireless?
I need a transistor and a wire.
But we'll be out of communication with the outside.
So?
When the time comes to take us out of Benish. Grant, listen.
Grant said impatiently, no. They can follow us through our radioactivity. The wireless is just for idle talk and we can do without. We have to, in fact. It's either radio silence or Benish's death.
For God's sake, man, call Carter and put it to him.
Grant thought briefly. I'll call him, but only to tell him there'll be no further messages.
If he orders you to make ready for withdrawal...
I'll refuse.
But if he orders you...
He can withdraw us by force, but without my cooperation. As long as we're aboard the Proteus, I make the policy decisions. We've gone through too much now to quit, so we go forward to the clot, whatever happens and whatever Carter orders.
Carter shouted, repeat last message.
Cannibalizing wireless to repair laser. This last message. Reed said blankly, they're breaking communication.
Carter said, what the devil happened to the laser?
Don't ask me.
Carter sat down heavily. Have coffee brought up here, will you, Don? If I thought I could get away with it, I'd ask for a double scotch and soda and then two more. We're jinxed.
Reed had signaled for coffee. He said, sabotage, maybe.
Sabotage?
Yes, and don't play innocent, General. You anticipated the possibility from the start, or why send Grant?
After what happened to Benish on the way here...
I know. And I don't particularly trust Duval or the girl either.
They're all right, said Carter, with a grimace. They've got to be. Everyone here has to be right. There is no way to make security more secure.
Exactly. No security procedure lends absolute certainty.
All these people work here.
Not Grant, said Reed.
Huh?
Grant doesn't work here. He's an outsider.
Carter smiled contortedly. He's a government agent.
Reed said, I know. And agents can play double games. You put Grant on the Proteus and a string of bad luck begins. Or what looks like bad luck.
The coffee had come. Carter said, that's ridiculous. I know the man. He's no stranger to me.
When was the last time you saw him? What do you know about his inner life?
Forget it. It's impossible.
But Carter stirred the cream into his coffee with a marked uneasiness. Reed said, all right, just thinking out loud.
Carter said, are they still in the Plura?
Yes. Carter looked at the time recorder, which said 32, and shook his head in frustration. Grant had the wireless in fragments before him. Cora looked at the transistors one after the other, turning them, weighing them, seeming almost to peer within them.
This one, she said doubtfully, will do, I think, but that wire is much too thick. Duval placed the wire under question on the illuminated opal glass and placed the damaged fragment of original wire next to it, comparing them with somber eyes.
Grant said, "There's nothing closer. You'll have to make it do."
"It's easy to say that," said Cora. "You can give me an order like that, but you can't give such an order to the wire. It won't work, no matter how hard you shout at it."
"All right, all right." Grant tried to think and got nowhere. Duval said, "Now wait. With luck, I may be able to scrape it thin enough. Miss Peterson, get me a number 11 scalpel." He placed the wire from what had been Grant's device, now wireless in literal truth, in two small clamps and swung a magnifying glass before it. He reached out for the scalpel, which Cora placed within his grip, and slowly he began to scrape. Without looking up, he said, "Kindly take your seat, Grant. You cannot help me by snorting over my shoulder." Grant flinched a little, caught Cora's look of appeal. He said nothing and moved back to his seat. Michaels, in his seat, greeted him humorlessly. "The surgeon is at work," he said. "The scalpel is in his hand, and his temperament is at once at its full bent. Don't waste your time being angry with him." Grant said, "I'm not angry with him." Michael said, "Of course you are, unless you're prepared to tell me you've resigned from the human race. Duval has the gift, the God-given gift, I'm sure he would say, of antagonizing people with a single word, a glance, a gesture. And if that weren't enough, there is the young lady." Grant turned to Michaels with clear impatience. "What about the young lady?"
"Come now, Grant, do you want a lecture on boys and girls?"
Grant frowned and turned away. Michael said softly, rather sadly,
"You're in a quandary about her, aren't you?"
"What quandary?"
"She's a nice girl, very good-looking, and yet you're a professionally suspicious person."
"Well?"
"Well, what happened to the laser? Was it an accident?"
"It could have been."
"Yes, it could have been." Michael's voice was a bare whisper. "But was it?"
Grant whispered too, after a quick glance over his shoulder. "Are you accusing Miss Peterson of sabotaging the mission?"
"I? Of course not. I have no evidence of that. But I suspect you are accusing her in your mind, and you don't like to be doing so. Hence the quandary."
"Why Miss Peterson?"
"Why not? Nobody would pay any attention to her if she were seen fiddling with a laser. It is her province. And if she were intent on sabotage, she would naturally gravitate to that part of the mission with which she felt most at home, the laser."
"Which would place immediate and automatic suspicion upon her, as it seems to have done," said Grant with some heat.
"I see. You are angry."
Grant said, "Look, we're all in one relatively small ship, and you might think that we were, each of us, under the close and constant observation of the others, but that's not so. We've been so absorbed with what's out there, all of us, that any one of us could have walked back to the storage compartment and done anything he wanted to the laser and done so unnoticed. You or I might have done it. I wouldn't have seen you. You wouldn't have seen me."
"Or Duval?"
"Or Duval. I'm not eliminating him. Or it might have been an honest accident."
"And your lifeline coming loose? Another accident?"
"Are you prepared to suggest anything else?"
"No, I'm not. I can point out a few things if you're in the mood."
"I'm not, but point them out anyway."
"It was Duval who secured your lifeline."
"And apparently made a poor knot, I suppose," said Grant. "Still, there was considerable tension on the line. Considerable."
"A surgeon should be able to tie knots."
"That's nonsense. Surgical knots are not sailor's knots."
"Perhaps. On the other hand, maybe the knot was deliberately tied so as to come loose. Or perhaps it could have been untied by hand."
Grant nodded. "All right. But there again, everyone had their attention on what was going on about them. You, or Duval, or Miss Peterson might have moved quickly back to the ship, loosened the knot, and returned without being noticed. Even Owens might have left the ship for the purpose, I suppose."
"Yes, but Duval had the best chance. Just before you broke loose, he went back to the ship, carrying the snorkel. He said the lifeline came loose as he watched. We know by his own admission that he was in the right place at the right time.
And it might still have been an accident. What's his motive? The laser had already been sabotaged, and all he could accomplish by loosening the lifeline would be to endanger me personally. If he was after the mission, why bother with me?
Oh, Grant, Grant.
Michael smiled and shook his head. Well, talk. Don't just grunt.
Suppose it was the young lady who took care of the laser. And suppose Duval's interest was specifically you. Suppose he wanted to get rid of you, with damage to the mission strictly secondary.
Grant stared speechlessly. Michaels went on.
Duval is perhaps not so entirely devoted to his work that he doesn't notice his assistant seems aware of your existence. You are a fine-looking young man, Grant, and you had saved her serious injury at the time of the whirlpool, perhaps even her life. Duval watched that, and he must have watched her reaction.
There was no reaction. She's not interested in me.
I watched her when you were lost in the alveolus. She was distraught. What was obvious to anyone then might have been obvious to Duval much sooner, that she was attracted to you. And he might have gotten rid of you for that reason.
Grant bit at his lower lip in thought, then said, All right. And the loss of air. Was that an accident, too? Michael shrugged.
I don't know. I suspect you will suggest that Owens might have been responsible for that.
He might. He knows the ship. He designed it. He can best gimmick its controls. And only he checked on what was wrong.
That's right, you know. That's right.
And for that matter, went on Grant with gathering anger, what about the arteriovenous fistula? Was that an accident? Or did you know it was there? Michael sat back in his chair and looked blank.
Good Lord, I hadn't thought of that. I give you my word, Grant. I sat here and honestly thought there wasn't a thing that happened that could possibly point in my direction specifically. I realized that it could be maintained that I had slyly damaged the laser or undone your lifeline knot or jammed the air chamber valve when no one was looking, or all three, for that matter. But in each case, it was so much more likely that someone else had done it. The fistula, I admit, could be no one but myself.
That's right.
Except, of course, that I didn't know it was there. But I can't prove that, can I?
No.
Michael said, Do you ever read detective stories, Grant?
In my younger days, I read quite a few. Now,
your profession spoils the fun, yes. I can well imagine that. But you know, in detective stories, it is always so simple. A subtle clue points to one person and one person only, and the detective sees it though no one else does. In real life, it seems, the clues point everywhere.
Or nowhere, said Grant firmly. We could be dealing with a series of accidents and misfortunes.
We could,
conceded Michaels. Neither, however, sounded very convincing. Or convinced. Chapter 14. Lymphatic. Owen's voice sounded from the bubble. Dr. Michaels, look ahead. Is that the turnoff? They could feel the Proteus slowing. Michaels muttered, Too much talk. I should have been watching. Immediately ahead was an open-ended tube. The thin walls facing them were ragged, almost fading away into nothingness. The opening was barely wide enough for the Proteus. Good enough, called out Michaels. Head into it. Cora had left the workbench to look forward in wonder, but Duval remained in his place, still working with infinite, untiring patience.
That must be a lymphatic, she said.
They had entered, and the walls surrounded them, no thicker than those of the capillary they had left some time back. As in the capillaries, the walls were made up quite clearly of cells in the shape of flat polygons, each with a rounded nucleus at the center. The fluid through which they were passing was very similar to that in the pleural cavity, sparkling yellowish in the Proteus headlights, and lending a yellow cast to the cells. The nuclei were deeper in color, almost orange. Grant said, Poached eggs. They look exactly like poached eggs. Then, what's a lymphatic?
It's an auxiliary circulatory system in a way,
said Cora, explaining eagerly. Fluid squeezes out of the very thin capillaries and collects in spaces in the body and between the cells. That's interstitial fluid. These drain off into tiny tubes, or lymphatics, that are open at their ends, as you saw just now. These tubes gradually combine into larger and larger tubes until the largest are the size of veins. All the lymph...
That's the fluid about us? Asked Grant.
Yes, all the lymph is collected into the largest lymphatic of all, the thoracic duct, which leads into the subclavian vein in the upper chest, and thus the lymph is restored to the main circulatory system.
And why have we entered the lymphatic?
Michaels leaned back, the course momentarily secure.
Well, he put in, it's a quiet backwater. There's no pumping effect of the heart. Muscular pressures and tensions move the fluid, and Benish isn't having many of those right now. So we can be assured a quiet journey to the brain.
Why didn't we enter the lymphatics to begin with, then?
They are small. An artery is a much better target for a hypodermic, and the arterial current was expected to carry us to target in minutes. It didn't work out, and to make our way back into an artery from here would delay us badly. Then, once we reached the artery, we would receive a battering which the ship might no longer be able to take.
He spread out a new set of charts and called out, Owens, are you following chart 72D?
Yes, Dr. Michaels.
Make sure you follow the path I've traced. It will take us through a minimum number of nodes.
Grant said, What's that up ahead?
Michaels looked up and froze. Slow the ship, he cried.
The Proteus decelerated vigorously. Through one portion of the wall of the widening tube, a shapeless mass protruded, milky, granular, and somehow threatening. But as they watched, it shrank and vanished.
Move on, said Michaels.
He said to Grant, I was afraid that white cell might be coming, but it was going, fortunately. Some of the white cells are formed in the lymph nodes, which are an important barrier against disease. They form not only white cells, but also antibodies.
And what are antibodies?
Protein molecules that have the capacity to combine specifically with various outside substances invading the body. Germs, toxins, foreign proteins.
And us?
And us, I suppose, under proper circumstances.
Cora interposed.
Bacteria are trapped in the nodes, which serve as a battleground between them and the white cells. The nodes swell up and become painful. You know, children get what are called swollen glands in the armpits or at the angle of the jaw.
And they're really swollen lymph nodes.
That's right.
Grant said, It sounds like a good idea to stay away from the lymph nodes.
Michaels said, We are small. Benish's antibody system is not sensitized to us, and there is only one series of nodes we need pass through, after which we have clear sailing. It's a chance, of course, but everything we do now is a chance.
Or, he demanded challengingly, are you going to set policy by ordering me out of the lymphatic system?
Grant shook his head.
No.
Not unless someone suggests a better alternative.
There it is, said Michaels, nudging Grant gently. See it?
The shadow up ahead?
Yes. This lymphatic is one of several that enters the node, which is a spongy mass of membranes and tortuous passages. The place is full of lymphocytes.
What are those?
One of the types of white cells. They won't bother us, I hope. Any bacteria in the circulatory system reaches a lymph node eventually. It can't negotiate the narrow, twisting channels.
Can we?
We move deliberately, Grant, and with an end in view, whereas bacteria drift blindly. You do see the difference, I hope. Once trapped in the node, the bacterium is handled by antibodies, or, if that fails, by white cells mobilized for battle.
The shadow was close now. The golden tinge of the lymph was darkening and turning cloudy. Up ahead, there seemed a wall.
Do you have the course, Owens? Michaels called out.
I have, but it's going to be easy to make a wrong turning. Even if you do, remember that at this moment we are heading generally upward. Keep the gravitometer indicator on the line as steadily as you can, and in the end, you can't go wrong.
The Proteus made a sharp turn, and suddenly all was gray. The headlights seemed to pick up nothing that was not a shadow of a deeper or lighter gray. There was an occasional small rod, shorter than the ship and much narrower, clumps of spherical objects, quite small, and with fuzzy boundaries.
Bacteria, muttered Michaels. I see them in too great detail to recognize the exact species. Isn't that strange? Too much detail. The Proteus was moving more slowly now, following the many gentle sweeps and turns of the channel almost hesitantly. Duval stepped to the door of the workroom. What's going on? I can't work on this thing if the ship doesn't hold a steady course. The Brownian motion is bad enough.
Sorry, Doctor, said Michaels coldly. We're passing through a lymph node, and this is the best we can do.
Duval, looking angry, turned away. Grant peered forward. It's getting messy up there, Dr. Michaels. What is that stuff that looks like seaweed or something?
Reticular fibers, said Michaels.
Owen said, Dr. Michaels?
Yes?
That fibrous stuff is getting thicker. I won't be able to maneuver through them without doing some damage to them.
Michaels looked thoughtful.
Don't worry about that. Any damage we do will, in any case, be minimal.
A clump of fibers pulled loose as the Proteus nudged into it, slipped and slid along the window, and vanished past the sides. It happened again and again with increasing frequency.
It's all right, Owens, said Michaels encouragingly. The body can repair damage like this without trouble.
I'm not worried about Benish, called out Owens. I'm worried about the ship. If this stuff clogs the vents, the engine will overheat. And it's adhering to us. Can't you tell the difference in the engine sound?
Grant couldn't, and his attention turned to the outside again.
The ship was nosing through a forest of tendrils now. They glinted a kind of menacing maroon in the headlights.
We'll get through it soon, said Michaels, but there was a definite note of anxiety in his voice.
The way did clear a bit, and now Grant could indeed sense a difference in the sound of the engines, almost a thickening hoarseness, as though the clear echo of gases bubbling through exhaust vents was being muffled and choked off. Owen shouted, Dead ahead! There was a soggy collision of a bacterial rod with a ship. The substance of the bacterium bent about the curve of the window, sprang back into shape and bounced off, leaving a smear that washed off slowly. There were others ahead.
What's going on? Said Grant in wonder.
I think, said Michaels, I think we're witnessing antibody reaction to bacteria. White cells aren't involved. See? Watch the walls of the bacteria. It's hard by the reflection of miniaturized light, but can you see it?
No, I'm afraid I can't. Duval's voice sounded behind them. I can't see anything either.
Grant turned. Is the wire adjusted, Doctor?
Not yet, said Duval. I can't work in this mess. It will have to wait.
What's this about antibodies?
Michael said.
As long as you're not working, let's have the inner lights out. Owens!
The lights went out, and the only illumination came from without, a ghostly, gray-maroon flicker that placed all their faces in angry shadow.
What's going on outside?
Asked Cora.
That's what I'm trying to explain, said Michaels. Watch the edges of the bacteria ahead.
Grant did his best, narrowing his eyes. The light was unsteady and flickering.
You mean those small objects that look like BB shot?
Exactly. They're antibody molecules. Proteins, you know, and large enough to see on our scale. There's one nearby. See it?
One of the small antibodies had swirled past the window. At close quarters, it did not seem to be a BB shot at all. It seemed rather larger than a BB, and to be a tiny tangle of spaghetti, vaguely spherical. Thin strands, visible only as fine glints of light, protruded here and there.
What are they doing? Asked Grant.
Each bacterium has a distinctive cell wall made out of specific atomic groupings hooked up in a specific way. To us, the various walls look smooth and featureless. But if we were smaller still, on the molecular scale instead of the bacterial, we'd see that each wall had a mosaic pattern, and that this mosaic was different and distinctive in each bacterial species. The antibodies can fit neatly upon this mosaic, and once they cover key portions of the wall, the bacterial cell is through. It would be like blocking a man's nose and mouth and choking him to death.
Cora said excitedly,
You can see them cluster. How horrible.
Are you sorry for the bacteria, Cora? Said Michael, smiling.
No, but the antibodies seem so vicious the way they pounce.
Michael said, Don't give them human emotions.
They are only molecules moving blindly. Interatomic forces pull them against those portions of the wall which they fit and hold them there. It's analogous to the clank of a magnet against an iron bar. Would you say the magnet attacks the iron viciously? Knowing what to look for, Grant could now see what was happening. A bacterium, moving blindly through a cloud of hovering antibodies, seemed to attract them, to pull them into itself. In moments, its wall had grown fuzzy with them. The antibodies lined up side by side, their spaghetti projections entangling. Grant said, "Some of the antibodies seem indifferent. They don't touch the bacterium." "The antibodies are specific," said Michaels. "Each one is designed to fit the mosaic of a particular kind of bacterium or of a particular protein molecule. Right now, most of the antibodies, though not all, fit the bacteria surrounding us. The presence of these particular bacteria has stimulated the rapid formation of this particular variety of antibody. How this stimulation is brought about, we still don't know."
"Good Lord," cried Duval. "Look at that."
One of the bacteria was now solidly encased in antibodies, which had followed its every irregularity, so that it seemed to be exactly as before, but with a fuzzy, thickened boundary. Cora said, "It fits perfectly."
"No, not that. Don't you see that the intermolecular bindings of the antibody molecules produce a kind of pressure on the bacterium? This was never clear even in electron microscopy, which only shows us dead objects."
A silence fell upon the crew of the Proteus, which was now moving slowly past the bacterium. The antibody coating seemed to stiffen and tighten, and the bacterium within writhed. The coating stiffened and tightened again, then again. And suddenly, the bacterium seemed to crumple and give way. The antibodies drew together, and what had been a rod became a featureless ovoid.
"They killed the bacterium. They literally squeezed it to death," said Cora, with revulsion.
"Remarkable," muttered Duval. "What a weapon for research we have in the Proteus."
Grant said,
"Are you sure we're safe from the antibodies?"
Michael said,
"It seems so. We're not the sort of thing for which antibodies are designed."
"Are you sure? I have a feeling they can be designed for any shape if properly stimulated."
"Well, you're right, I suppose. Still, we're obviously not stimulating them."
Owens called out, "More fibers ahead, Dr. Michaels. We're pretty well coated with the stuff. It's cutting down our speed."
Michaels said, "We're almost out of the node, Owens."
Occasionally, a writhing bacterium slammed against the ship, which shuddered in response, but the fight was thinning out now, the bacteria clearly the losers. The Proteus was bumping and nudging its way through fibers again.
"Right ahead," said Michaels. "One more left turn, and we're at the efferent lymphatic."
Owens said,
"We're trailing the fibers. The Proteus looks like a shaggy dog."
Grant said, "How many more lymph nodes on the course to the brain?"
"Three more. One may be avoidable. I'm not quite sure."
"We can't do that. We lose too much time. We won't make it through three more like this. Are there any shortcuts?"
Michael shook his head.
"None that won't create problems worse than those we now face. Sure, we'll make it through the nodes. The fibers will wash off, and if we don't stop to look at bacterial warfare, we can go faster."
"And next time," said Grant, frowning, "we'll meet a fight involving white cells."
Duval stepped over to Michael's charts and said,
"Where are we now, Michaels?"
"Right here," said Michaels, watching the surgeon narrowly.
Duval thought a moment and said,
"Let me get my bearings. We're in the neck now, aren't we?"
"Yes."
Grant thought, "In the neck?" Right where they had started. He looked at the time recorder. It said 28. More than half the time gone, and they were back where they had started. Duval said,
"Can't we avoid all nodes and actually take a shortcut, too, if we turn off somewhere around here and make straight for the inner ear? From that to the clot is no distance at all."
Michaels wrinkled his forehead into a washboard and sighed.
"On the map, that looks fine. You make a quick mark on the chart and you're home safe. But have you thought what passing through the inner ear means?"
Duval said,
"Now, what?"
"The ear, my dear doctor, as I needn't tell you, is a device for concentrating and amplifying sound waves. The slightest sound outside, will set up intense vibrations in the inner ear. On our miniaturized scale, those vibrations will be deadly."
Duval looked thoughtful.
"Yes, I see."
Grant said,
"Is the inner ear always vibrating?"
"Unless there's silence, with no sound above the hearing threshold.
Even then, on our scale, we'll probably detect some gentle motions.
Worse than Brownian motion?
Perhaps not.
Grant said, the sound has to come from outside, doesn't it? If we pass through the inner ear, the throbbing of the ship's engine or the sound of our voices won't affect it, will it?
No, I'm sure it won't. The inner ear isn't designed for our miniaturized vibrations.
Well then, if the people out there in the hospital room maintain complete silence,
how will we get them to do so? Demanded Michaels.
Then almost brutally,
you demolished the wireless, so we can't get in touch with them.
But they can track us. They'll find us heading for the inner ear. They'll understand the need for silence.
Will they?
Won't they? Said Grant impatiently. Most of them there are medical men. They have an understanding of such matters.
Do you want to take that kind of chance?
Grant looked about. What do the rest of you think? Owen said, I'll follow any course that's set for me, but I'm not going to set it for myself. Duval said, I'm not sure.
Michael said, and I am sure. I'm against it.
Grant looked briefly at Cora, who sat in silence. All right, he said. The responsibility is mine. We're heading for the inner ear. Set the course, Michaels.
Michael said, look here.
The decision is made, Michaels. Set the course. Michaels flushed and then shrugged.
Owens, he said coldly, we'll have to make a sharp left turn at the point I am now indicating.
Chapter 15. Ear. Carter lifted his coffee cup absently. Drops of liquid slipped off and landed on his pants leg. He noticed that, but paid it no attention.
What do you mean, they veered off?
I should guess they felt they had spent too much time in the lymph node and didn't want to go through any more of them, said Reed.
All right. Where are they going instead?
I'm not positive yet, but they seem to be headed for the inner ear. I'm not sure that I approve of that. Carter put down his cup again and shoved it to one side. He had not placed it to his lips.
Why not?
He glanced quickly at the time recorder. It read 27.
It will be difficult. We'll have to watch out for sound.
Why?
You can figure it out, can't you, Al? The ear reacts to sound. The cochlea vibrates. If the Proteus is anywhere near it, it will vibrate too, and it may vibrate to destruction.
Carter leaned forward in his seat, staring at Reed's calm face.
Why the hell are they going there, then?
I suppose because they think that's the only route that will get them to destination fast enough. Or, on the other hand, they may just be crazy. We have no way of telling, since they cannibalized their wireless.
Carter said, are they in there yet? In the inner ear, I mean?
Reed flicked a switch and asked a quick question. He turned back. Just about.
Do the men down there in the operating room understand about the necessity for silence?
I suppose so.
You suppose so? What good is supposing?
They won't be in it long.
They'll be in it long enough. Listen, you tell those men down there... No, too late to take a chance. Get me a piece of paper and call in someone from outside. Anyone, anyone.
An armed security man came in and saluted.
Oh, shut up, said Carter wearily.
He didn't return the salute. He had scribbled on the paper in block letters, silence. Absolute silence while Proteus is in ear.
Take this, he said to the security man. You go down into the operating room and show it to each man. Make sure he looks at it. If you make any noise, I'll kill you. If you say one word, I'll disembowel you first. Do you understand?
Yes, sir, he said, but looked confused and alarmed.
Go ahead. Hurry. Damn it, take off your shoes.
Sir?
Take them off. You walk into that room on stocking feet.
They watched from the observation room, counting the interminable seconds until the stockinged soldier walked into the operating room. From doctor to nurse to doctor he went, holding up the paper and jerking a thumb up toward the control room. Person after person nodded grimly. None budged from his or her spot. For a moment it seemed a mass paralysis had gripped everyone in the room.
Obviously they understand, said Reed, even without instructions.
I congratulate them, said Carter savagely. Now listen, you get in touch with the various guys at controls. No buzzers must sound, no bells, no gongs, nothing. For that matter, no flashing lights. I don't want anyone to be startled into as much as a grunt.
They'll be through in a few seconds,
Maybe, said Carter, and maybe not. Hop to it.
Reed hopped to it. The Proteus had entered a wide region of pure liquid. Except for a few antibodies flashing by now and then, there was nothing to be seen except the glitter of the ship's headlights making its way through the yellow-tinged lymph. A dim sound below the threshold of hearing rubbed over the ship, almost as though it had slid against the washboard. Then again, and again. Michaels called out, Owens, put out the cabin lights, will you? The exterior leaped into greater clarity at once. Do you see that? Michaels asked. The others stared. Grant saw nothing at all. We're in the cochlear duct, said Michaels. Inside the little spiral tube in the inner ear that does our hearing for us. This one does Benish's hearing for him. It vibrates to sound in different patterns. See? Now Grant saw. It was almost like a shadow in the fluid, a huge, flat shadow whipping past them. It's a sound wave, said Michaels, at least in a manner of speaking, a wave of compression which we somehow make out with our miniaturized light.
Does that mean someone is talking? Asked Cora.
Oh, no. If someone were talking or making any real sound, this thing would heave like the granddaddy of all earthquakes. Even in absolute silence, though. The cochlea picks up sounds. The distant thud of the heartbeat, the rasp of blood working through the tiny veins and arteries of the ear and so on. Didn't you ever cup your ear with a shell and listen to the sound of the ocean? What you're listening to mainly is the magnified sound of your own ocean, the bloodstream.
Grant said, Will this be dangerous?
Michael shrugged. No worse than it is, if no one talks.
Duval, back in the workroom, and bent over the laser once more, said, Why are we slowing?
Owens!
Owens said, Something's wrong. The engine is choking off, and I don't know why.
There was the slowly intensifying sensation of being in a down-dropping elevator as the Proteus settled lower in the duct. They hit bottom with a slight jar, and Duval put down his scalpel.
Now what? Owens said anxiously. The engine is overheating, and I had to stop it. I think...
What?
It must be those reticular fibers, the damned seaweed. It must have blocked the intake vents. There's nothing else I can think of that would be causing this.
Can you blow them out? Asked Grant tensely. Owens shook his head.
Not a chance. Those are intake vents. They suck inward.
Well, then, there's only one thing to do, said Grant. It has to be cleaned off from the outside, and that means more skin diving.
With furrowed brow, he began to clamber into his diving outfit. Cora was looking anxiously out the window. She said, There are antibodies out there.
Not many, said Grant briefly.
But what if they attack?
Not likely, said Michaels reassuringly. They're not sensitized to the human shape. And as long as no damage is done to the tissues themselves, the antibodies probably will remain passive.
See, said Grant, but Cora shook her head. Duval, who had listened for a moment, bent down to look at the wire he was shaving, matching it against the original wire thoughtfully, and then turning it in his hand slowly to try to gauge the evenness of its cross-section. Grant dropped out the ventral hatch of the ship, landing on the soft rubber elasticity of the lower wall of the cochlear duct. He looked ruefully at the ship. It was not the clean, smooth metal it had been. It looked furry, shaggy. He kicked off into the lymph, propelling himself toward the bow of the ship. Owens was quite correct. The intake valves were choked with the fibers. Grant seized a double handful and pulled. They came loose with difficulty, many breaking off at the surface of the vent filters. Michael's voice reached him over his small receiver.
How is it?
Pretty damn rotten, said Grant.
How long will it take you? We've got a 26 reading on the time recorder.
It's going to take me quite a while.
Grant yanked desperately, but the viscosity of the lymph slowed his movements and the tenacity of the fibers seemed to fight back. Within the ship, Cora said tensely,
Wouldn't it be better if some of us went out to help him?
Well, no, began Michaels doubtfully.
I'm going to.
She seized her suit.
Michael said, All right, I will too. Owens had better stay at the controls.
Duval said,
And I think I had better stay right here too. I have this thing almost done.
Of course, Dr. Duval, said Cora. She adjusted her swimming mask. The task was scarcely eased by the fact that three of them were soon wiggling about the ship's bow, all three snatching desperately at the fibers, pulling them loose,
letting them drift away in the slow current. The metal of the filters was beginning to show, and Grant pushed some recalcitrant pieces into the vent.
I hope this doesn't do any harm, but I can't get them out. Owens, what if some of these fibers get into the vents? Inside, I mean.
Owens' voice in his ear said,
Then they get carbonized in the motor and foul it. It will mean a nasty cleaning job when we're through.
Once we get through, I don't care if you have to scrap this stinking ship. Grant pushed at the fibers that were flush with the filters and pulled at those that weren't. Cora and Michaels did the same.
Cora said, We're making it.
Michael said,
But we're in the cochlea a lot longer than we had expected to be. At any moment, some sound...
Shut up, said Grant irritably, and finish the job.
Carter made as if to tear at his hair and then held back.
No, 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 no,
he cried. They've stopped again.
He pointed at the message written on a piece of paper and held up in his direction from one of the television screens.
At least he remembered not to talk, said Reed. Why do you suppose they've stopped?
How in blue blazing damnation do I know? Maybe they've stopped for a coffee break. Maybe they've decided to stop for a sunbath. Maybe the girl...
He broke off.
Well, I don't know. All I do know is that we have only 24 minutes left.
Reed said, The longer they stay in the inner ear, the more nearly certain it will be that some joker will make a sound. Sneeze, something.
You're right,
Carter thought, then said softly,
Oh, for the love of Mike. It's the simple solutions we don't see. Call in that messenger boy.
The security man entered again. He didn't salute.
Carter said, You still have your shoes off?
Okay, take this down and show it to one of the nurses.
You remember about the disemboweling?
Yes, sir.
The message read, Cotton at Benish's ears. Carter lit a cigar and watched through the control window as the security man entered, hesitated a moment, then moved with quick, gingerly steps to one of the nurses. She smiled, looked up at Carter, and made a circle of her thumb and forefinger.
Carter said, I have to think of everything.
Reed said, It will just deaden the noise. It won't stop it.
You know what they say about half a loaf, said Carter.
The nurse slipped off her own shoes and was at one of the tables in two steps. Carefully, she opened a fresh box of absorbent cotton and unrolled 2 feet of it. She pulled off a fistful in one hand and seized a fistful in the other. It didn't come readily. She pulled harder. Her hand went flying outward, striking a pair of scissors on the table. It skittered off the table, striking the hard floor. The nurse's foot flew desperately after it, clamping down upon it hard, but not until after it had given out one sharp, metallic clang, like the hiccup of a fallen angel. The nurse's face reddened into a look of deathly horror. Everyone else in the room turned to stare, and Carter, dropping his cigar, crumpled into his chair.
Finished, he said.
Owens turned on the engine and gently checked the controls. The needle on the temperature gauge, which had been well into the danger zone almost since they had entered the cochlear duct, was dropping.
He said, It looks good. Are you all set out there?
Grant's voice sounded in his ear.
Nothing much left. Get ready to move. We're coming in.
And at that moment, the universe seemed to heave. It was as though a fist had driven up against the Proteus, which lifted high. Owens seized a panel for support and held on desperately, listening to a distant thunder. Below, Duval, as desperately, held on to the laser, trying to cushion it against a world gone mad. Outside, Grant felt himself flung high in the air as though caught in the grip of a huge tidal wave. He flipped over and over and plunged into the wall of the cochlear duct. He was shaken loose from the wall, which seemed to be caving forward. Somewhere in a miraculously calm segment of his mind, Grant knew that on the ordinary scale, the wall was responding with rapid vibrations of microscopic amplitude to some sharp sound. But that thought was buried in sheer shock. Grant tried desperately to locate the Proteus, but he caught only a quick glimpse of its headlights flashing against a distant section of the wall. Cora had been holding on to a projection of the Proteus at the moment the vibration had struck. Instinctively, her grip tightened, and for a moment she rode the Proteus as though it were an insanely bucking bronco. The breath was jerked out of her, and when her grip was torn away, she went skidding across the floor of the membrane on which the ship had been resting. The ship's headlights caught the path ahead of her, and though she tried in horror to break her motion, it was quite useless.
she might as well have tried to dig her heels into the ground in order to stop an avalanche. She was heading, she knew, for a section of the organ of Corti, the basic center of hearing. Included among the components of the organ were the hair cells, 15,000 of them altogether. She could make out a few of them now, each with its delicate, microscopic cilium held high. Certain numbers of them vibrated gently according to the pitch and intensity of the sound waves conducted into the inner ear and there amplified. That, however, was as she might have considered it in some course in physiology. Phrases as they might have been used in the universe of normal scale. Here, what she saw was a sheer precipice, and beyond it, a series of tall, graceful columns, moving in stately fashion, not all in unison, but rather first one and then another, as though a swaying wave were rippling over the entire structure. Cora went skidding and spinning over the precipice into a world of vibrating columns and walls. Her headlight flashed erratically as she went tumbling downward. She felt the pull of something on her harness and swung forcefully against a firmly elastic object. She dangled head downward, afraid to struggle lest whatever projection had stopped her would give way and let her fall the rest of the way. She spun first this way, then that, as the column against which she clung, a microscopic cilium on one hair cell of the organ of Corti, continued to sway majestically. She was managing to breathe now and heard her own name. Someone was calling. Carefully, she made a pleading sound. Encouraged by the sound of her voice, she screamed as shrilly as she could, "Help! Everybody! Help!" The first devastating shock had passed, and Owens was bringing the Proteus under control in a still turbulent sea. The sound, whatever it was, might have been intense, but it had been sharp and quick dying. That alone saved them, had it continued for even a short time. Duval, cradling the laser under one arm and seated with his back against the wall and his legs pressing desperately against a bench support, shouted, "All clear! I think we pulled through," gasped Owens. "The controls respond." "We had better leave. We've got to pick up the others," Duval said. "Oh, yes, I had forgotten." Carefully, he rolled over, got one hand beneath to steady himself, and then slowly made it to his feet. He still clutched the laser.
"Get them in," Owens called.
"Michaels, Grant, Miss Peterson."
"Coming in," responded Michaels. "I think I'm in one piece."
"Wait," called Grant. "I don't see Cora." The Proteus was steady now, and Grant, breathing heavily and feeling more than a little shaken, was swimming strongly toward its headlight. He called, "Cora." She answered shrilly,
"Help! Everybody, help!"
Grant looked about in every direction. He shouted desperately,
"Cora, where are you?"
Her voice in his ear said,
"I can't tell you exactly. I'm caught among the hair cells."
"Where are they? Michaels, where are the hair cells?"
Grant could make out Michaels approaching the ship from another direction, his body a dim shadow in the lymph, his small headlight cutting a thin swath ahead of him. Michaels said,
"Wait, let me get my bearings."
He flipped quickly, then shouted,
"Owens, turn on ship's headlight wide angle."
Light spread in response, and Michael said,
"This way. Owens, follow me. We'll need the light."
Grant followed Michael's quickly moving figure and saw the precipice and columns ahead.
"In there?"
he asked uncertainly.
"Must be,"
returned Michaels. They were at the edge now, with the ship behind them and its headlights spilling into the cavernous file of columns, still swaying gently.
"I don't see her,"
said Michaels.
"I do," said Grant, pointing. "Isn't that she? Cora, I see you. Move your arm so I can be certain."
She waved.
"All right, I'm coming to get you. We'll have you back in a shake and a half."
Cora waited and felt a touch at her knee, the faintest and gentlest sensation, like that of a fly's wing brushing against her. She looked toward her knee, but saw nothing. There was another touch near her shoulder, then still another. Quite suddenly, she made them out, just a few, the little balls of wool with their quivering, out-thrusting filaments, the protein molecules of the antibodies. It was almost as though they were exploring her surface, testing her, tasting her, deciding whether she were harmless or not. There were only a few, but more were drifting toward her from among the columns. With the headlights from the Proteus shining down, she could make them out clearly in the glittering reflection of miniaturized light. Each filament shone like a questing sunbeam. She screamed,
"Come quickly! There are antibodies all about!"
In her thoughts, she could see all too clearly the antibodies coating the bacterial cell, fuzzing it completely, then crushing it as intermolecular forces drew the antibodies together. An antibody had touched her elbow and was clinging there. She shook her arm in revulsion and horror so that her whole body writhed and went slamming into the column. The antibody did not shake loose. Another joined it, the two fitting together neatly, filaments interlaced.
"Antibodies," muttered Grant.
Michael said, "She must have done enough damage to surrounding tissue to spark their appearance."
"Can they do anything to her?"
"Not immediately. They're not sensitized to her. No antibodies are deliberately designed for her form, but some will fit somewhere on a sheerly random basis, and she will stimulate the formation of more like those that do fit. Then they'll come swarming."
Grant could see them now, swarming already, settling about her like a cloud of tiny fruit flies. He said, "Michaels, get back to the sub. One person is enough to risk. I'll get her out of here somehow. If I don't, it'll be up to the three of you to get whatever's left of us back into the ship. We can't be allowed to demiliterize here, whatever happens."
Michaels hesitated, then said, "Take care," and turned, hastening back to the Proteus. Grant continued to plunge toward Korra. The turbulence caused by his approach sent the antibody spinning and dancing rapidly.
"Let's get you out of here, Korra," he panted.
"Oh, Grant, quickly."
He was pulling desperately at her oxygen cylinders, which had cut into a column and stuck. Thick strands of viscous material were still oozing outward from the break, and it was that, perhaps, which had triggered the arrival of the antibodies.
"Don't move, Korra. Let me..."
Ah! Korra's ankle was caught between two fibers, and he strained them apart. "Now, come with me."
Both executed a half-somersault and started moving away. Korra's body was fuzzed with clinging antibodies, but the bulk were left behind. Then, following who knew what kind of equivalent of scent on the microscopic scale, they began to follow. First a few, then many, then the entire growing swarm.
"We'll never make it,"
gasped Korra.
"Yes, we will," said Grant. "Just put every muscle you have into it."
"But they're still attaching themselves. I'm scared, Grant."
Grant looked over his shoulder at her, then fell back slightly. Her back was half covered by a mosaic of the wool balls. They had gauged the nature of her surface well, that part of it at least. He brushed her back hurriedly, but the antibodies clung, flattening out at the touch of his hand and springing back into shape afterward. A few were now beginning to probe and taste Grant's body.
"Faster, Korra."
"But I can't."
"But you can. Hang on to me, will you?" They shot upward, over the lip of the precipice, to the waiting Proteus.
Duval helped Michaels up through the hatch.
"What's happening out there?"
Michaels pulled off his helmet, gasping.
"Miss Peterson was trapped in the cells of Henson. Grant is trying to get her loose, but antibodies are swarming over her."
Duval's eyes widened.
"What can we do?"
"I don't know. Maybe he can get her back. Otherwise, we've got to go on."
Owen said,
"But we can't leave them there."
"Of course not," said Duval.
"We've got to go out there, all three of us, and..."
Then, harshly,
"Why are you back here, Michaels? Why aren't you out there?"
Michaels looked at Duval hostily.
"Because I wouldn't have done any good. I haven't got Grant's muscles or his reflexes. I'd have been in the way. If you want to help, get out there yourself."
Owen said,
"We've got to get them back, alive or...
otherwise.
They'll be demiliterizing in about a quarter of an hour."
"All right, then," shouted Duval. "Get into your swimsuit and let's get out there."
"Wait," said Owens. "They're coming. I'll get the hatch ready."
Grant's hand was clutching firmly at the wheel of the hatch, while the signal light flashed redly above it. He picked at the antibodies on Cora's back, pinching the wool-like fibers of one between thumb and forefinger, feeling its soft springiness give and then become a wiry core that gave no further. He thought, "This is a peptide chain." Dim memories of college courses came back. He had once been able to write the chemical formula of a portion of a peptide chain, and here was the real thing. If he had a microscope, could he see the individual atoms? No, Michaels had said those would fuzz into nothing no matter what he could do. He lifted the antibody molecule. It clung tightly at first, then gave, sucking free. Neighboring molecules clinging to it pulled loose too. An entire patch came free, and Grant swung it away, batting at it. They remained together and came back, seeking their clinging point. They had no brains, not even the most primitive,
and it was wrong to think of them as monsters or predators or even fruit flies. They were merely molecules with atoms so arranged as to make them cling to the surfaces that fit theirs through the blind action of interatomic forces. A phrase came back to Grant from the recesses of memory, Van der Waals forces. Nothing more. He kept pulling at the fuzz on Cora's back. She cried out,
"They're coming, Grant! Let's get into the hatch!"
Grant looked back. They were finding their way, sensing their presence. Links and chains of them were swooping high above the lip of the precipice and coming down in their general direction like blinded cobras. Grant said, "We've got to wait." The light turned green. "All right, now." He whirled at the wheel desperately. The antibodies were all about them, but making chiefly for Cora. For her, they had already been sensitized, and there was far less hesitation now. They clung and joined, spanning her shoulders and making their woolly pattern across her abdomen. They hesitated over the uneven, three-dimensional curve of her breasts as though they had not figured that out yet. Grant had no time to aid Cora in her ineffectual clutchings at the antibodies. He pulled the hatch door open, thrust Cora into it, antibodies and all, and squeezed in after her. The hatch barely held both. He pushed forcefully against the hatch door while antibodies continued to pour in. The door closed upon their elasticity, but the basic wiriness of hundreds of them clogged the door at the end. He bent his back against the pressure of that wiriness and managed to turn the wheel that locked the door in place. A dozen little balls of wool, so soft and almost cuddly when viewed separately and in themselves, wriggled feebly in the crack where the hatch door met the wall, but hundreds of others, untrapped, filled the fluid about them. Air pressure was pushing the fluid out and hissing filled their ears, but at the moment Grant was concerned only to pull the antibodies loose. Some were settling on his own chest, but that didn't matter. Cora's midriff was buried in them, as was her back. They had formed a solid band about her body from breast to thigh. She said,
"They're tightening, Grant."
Through her mask, he could see the agony in her face, and he could hear the effort it took her to speak. The water was sinking rapidly, but they couldn't wait. Grant hammered at the inner door.
I can't breathe,
gasped Cora. The door opened, the fluid it still held pouring into the main body of the ship. Duval's hand, thrusting through, seized Cora's arm and pulled her in. Grant followed. Owen said,
"Lord, help us! Look at them!"
With an expression of distaste and nausea, he started plucking at the antibodies as Grant had been doing. A strand tore, then another, then still another. Half laughing, Grant said, "It's easy now. Just brush them off." All were doing so now. They fell into the inch or so of fluid on the floor of the ship and moved feebly. Duval said,
"They're designed to work in body fluid, of course. Once they're surrounded by air, the molecular attractions alter in nature."
"As long as they're off. Cora." Cora was breathing in deep, shuddering gasps. Gently, Duval removed her headpiece, but it was to Grant's arm she clung as she suddenly burst into tears.
"I was so scared," she sobbed.
"Both of us were," Grant assured her. "Will you stop thinking it's a disgrace to be frightened? There's a purpose to fear, you know." He was stroking her hair slowly. "It makes the adrenaline flow so that you can swim that much faster and longer and endure that much more. An efficient fear mechanism is good basic material for heroism." Duval pushed Grant impatiently to one side. "Are you all right, Miss Peterson?" Cora took a deep breath and said, with an effort, but in a steady voice,
"Quite all right, Doctor."
Owen said,
"We've got to get out of here."
He was in the bubble.
"We have practically no time left."
Chapter 16. Brain. In the control room, the television receivers seemed to spring back into life.
"General Carter."
"Yes, what now?"
"They're moving again, sir. They're out of the ear and heading rapidly for the clot."
"Ha! They survived."
He looked at the time recorder, which read 12.
12 minutes.
Vaguely, he looked about for the cigar and found it on the floor, where he had dropped it and then stepped on it. He picked it up, looked at its flatly mangled shape, and threw it away in disgust.
12 minutes. Can they still make it, Reed?
Reed was crumpled in his chair, looking miserable.
They can make it. They can even get rid of the clot, maybe. But I don't know if we can get them out in time. We can't probe into the brain to pull them out, you know. If we could do that, we would have been able to probe into it for the clot in the first place. That means they've got to get to the brain and then proceed to some point where they can be removed. If they don't..."
Carter said querulously,
I've been brought two cups of coffee and one cigar, and I haven't had one sip or one puff.
They're reaching the base of the brain, sir, came the word. Michaels was back at his chart. Grant was at his shoulder, staring at the complexities before him. Is that the clot here?
Yes,
said Michaels.
It looks a long distance off. We only have 12 minutes.
It's not as far away as it looks. We'll have clear sailing now. We'll be at the base of the brain in less than a minute, and from there, in no time at all...
There was a sudden flood of light pouring in all about the ship. Grant looked up in astonishment and saw, outside, a tremendous wall of milky light, its boundaries invisible.
The eardrum, said Michaels. On the other side, the outside world.
An almost unbearably poignant homesickness pulled at Grant. He had almost forgotten that there was an outside world. It seemed to him at the moment that all his life he had been traveling endlessly through a nightmare world of tubes and monsters, a flying Dutchman of the circulatory system. But there it was. The light of the outside world filtering through the eardrum. Michael said, bending over the chart,
You ordered me back into the ship from the hair cells, didn't you, Grant?
Yes, I did, Michaels. I wanted you on the ship, not at the hair cells.
You tell that to Duval. His attitude...
Why worry? His attitude is always unpleasant, isn't it?
This time he was insulting. I don't pretend to be a hero.
I'll bear witness on your behalf.
Thank you, Grant. And keep an eye on Duval.
Grant laughed.
Of course.
Duval approached almost as though he realized he was being discussed, and said brusquely, Where are we, Michaels? Michaels looked at him with a bitter expression and said,
We're about to enter the subarachnoid cavity, right at the base of the brain, he added, in Grant's direction.
All right, suppose we go in past the oculomotor nerve.
All right, said Michaels. If that will give you the most favorable shot of the clot, that's how we'll go in.
Grant backed away and bent his head to get into the storage room where Cora was lying on a cot. She made as though to get up, but he lifted his hand.
Don't. Stay there.
And he sat on the floor beside her, knees up and enclosed in his arms. He smiled at her. She said,
I'm all right now. I'm just malingering lying here.
Why not? You're the most beautiful malingerer I've ever seen. Let's malinger together for a minute if you don't think that sounds too improper.
She smiled in her turn. It would be difficult for me to complain that you were too forward. After all, you seem to make a career of saving my life.
All part of a shrewd and extraordinarily subtle campaign to place you under an obligation to me.
I am, most decidedly.
I'll remind you of that at the proper time.
Please do. But, Grant, really, thank you.
I like your thanking me, but... It's my job. That's why I was sent along. Remember, I make decisions on policy, and I take care of emergencies.
But that's not all, is it?
It's quite enough, protested Grant. I plug snorkels into lungs, pull seaweed out of intakes, and, most of all, I hold on to beautiful women.